This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel's designation of six Palestinian civil society and human rights groups as terrorists draws strong condemnation from Palestinians, the United Nations and U.S. lawmakers. North Korea says the growing U.S. military presence in the region and Washington's support for Taiwan are a potential threat to Pyongyang. Also ahead, a summit of European Union leaders is overshadowed by divisions on a range of key subjects. We'll have a report from Brussels. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Israel's designation of six Palestinian civil society and human rights groups as terrorist organizations has sparked outrage both inside and outside the occupied territories. The Palestinian Prime Minister, Mohammed Shetaya, strongly condemned the move. He said the Palestinian organizations worked with international institutions, and thus their blacklisting is a serious violation of international law. Shetaya called on world leaders, or world bodies, I should say, to denounce the designations and prevent their implementation. The spokesman for the Hamas resistance movement also blasted the Israeli move as terrorist behavior. Hazem Qasim said the move disregards international law and wages a war on Palestinians' existence. The United Nations Human Rights Office in the Palestinian territories also expressed alarm.
Counter-terrorism legislation must not be used to constrain legitimate human rights and humanitarian work. These designations are the latest developments in a long stigmatizing campaign against these and other organizations, damaging their ability to deliver on their crucial work.
Three U.S. Democratic lawmakers also condemned Israel's move as an attempt to silence advocates of Palestinian rights and called for its withdrawal. Among them, Representative Ilhan Omar called for the immediate consequences from the United States and the international community. The six Palestinian groups were blacklisted by Israel after the regime accused them of financing the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. International human rights groups have slammed the move as appalling and unjust. And the international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan gave us a detailed explanation on why Israel's designation of the Palestinian rights groups is illegal.
Well, what Israel is doing is clearly illegal. They're trying to apply a vague law that
that they have within their own jurisdiction, but they're trying to also apply this Israeli law to territory that's not under their jurisdiction, namely the occupied territories, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza. So you're applying Israeli law to an area that is not legally or even technically controlled by Israel. So that's one major problem. You know, these organizations are under attack because they were effective. They have been very good at exposing difficulties and war crimes. Some of the organizations have also been very critical of the Palestinian Authority, so they're balanced. And they've worked with, you know, virtually every single human rights organization and international organization, including the United Nations.
The leader of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, says supporting the Palestinian cause is a main priority for Muslims and a moral duty for everyone. Said Hassan Nasrallah also warned about drilling for oil and gas in a disputed maritime area. Mariam Saleh reports from Beirut.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah has warned the Israelis that any drilling in disputed areas will not go unpunished.
If the enemy believes it can act as it wishes in the disputed area before the talks are finalized, they are wrong. I do not want to complicate the talks, but I say definitely, the resistance in Lebanon and at the appropriate time as it follows up this case, and when it finds that Lebanon's petrol and gas, even in disputed areas, are in danger, then the resistance will act accordingly based on this principle, and it is capable to do so.
These words were in response to reports that the Israelis have contracted an American company to begin drilling in the disputed areas while U.S.-mediated indirect talks continue. The leader of the resistance stressed that the capabilities he had spoken of last Monday are to be used to defend Lebanon and protect its resources. Nasrallah spoke at a ceremony to commemorate the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad. Nasrallah said that supporting the Palestinian cause is a main priority for Muslims and a moral duty for everyone. He also called for unity among Muslims. Experts believe Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's words are an example for all people to unite on the principles of freedom and humanity.
The Lebanese constitution does not say this country is Muslim or Christian, and while Hezbollah and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah want to unite Lebanon on slogans of freedom and sovereignty, others don't want this. To have freedom, we need to have resistance. We need to defeat Israel to gain complete sovereignty.
The people who gathered at the site said it is their duty to celebrate the birth of the Prophet and to show their support for the resistance.
The fact that we are here in light of all the circumstances is in itself a point of strength. And this ceremony is important to us because Prophet Muhammad and his teachings is everything for us to teach us how to act and what to do.
Despite the various political and economic challenges, the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad has given Lebanese people a reason to celebrate and ask for mercy from God, as his prophet was a blessing to all mankind. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Now, the United Nations says the first round of talks in Geneva between the Syrian government and the opposition on the constitution drafting process has ended in a big disappointment. The UN envoy for Syria, Geir Pedersen, said, quote, "We didn't manage to achieve what we had hoped for." He said the negotiators failed to move forward to reach some kind of consensus. The talks started Monday following a nine-month hiatus in the UN-led meetings of the Syrian Constitutional Committee, where government, opposition, and civil society are represented. This week, the delegations returned to Geneva. After mediation by Pedersen, they had agreed on a mechanism to begin drafting a new constitution for Syria as part of the UN-led political process to end the years-old conflict in the Arab country. North Korea has accused the United States of raising military tensions with China through its support for Taiwan. Vice Foreign Minister Park Myung says such, quote, "reckless backing plus the growing U.S. military presence in the region pose a potential threat to North Korea." Park believes that the U.S. is meddling in China's internal affairs with its policy on Taiwan. He has also slammed Washington for providing Taipei with upgraded weapons systems and military training. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory and has vowed to bring it under control by force if necessary. In fresh inflammatory comments, US President Joe Biden has said that Washington is committed to defend Taiwan if it comes under attack from China. Political commentator Richard Becker says Washington's military support for Taiwan contradicts the US claim that it doesn't want to engage in a military confrontation with China.
What the U.S. strategicians are looking at is a surrounding China with U.S. military power based in Japan, Okinawa, Taiwan is particularly important, Philippines, Borneo, what they call, what the commanders now call the first island chain. First island meaning the set of island nations which, as you come east, from China are along the or somewhat close to the China coast, but the U.S. is preparing all of them, and it says that they must. U.S. commanders say they must prepare and be prepared, not only to engage in war, but to engage in a war with enough redundancy in their military stockpiles to be able to continue fighting even after they're hit. I don't think the people of those countries, and I don't think the people of the United States, have any interest in a war with China. But we cannot accept that, on the one hand, the U.S. government says that they don't want war, but they're sending trainers and vast quantities of military equipment to Taiwan and to other allies in the region.
A summit of EU leaders in Brussels has been overshadowed by divisions on a range of key subjects: the rule of law, COVID-19, energy costs, and the Afghan refugee crisis were among the issues debated. Jerome Hughes has the details.
This was the first face-to-face meeting of EU leaders since the bloc's energy crisis really came to the fore. Millions of citizens simply don't have the money to pay for electricity and gas bills, which have skyrocketed since the start of the year.
We will intensify our outreach to the different suppliers, also to diversify the supply we do have, and we have to speed up the work on interconnections.
Experts say Iran, with its enormous oil and gas reserves, is an obvious option for the EU. Illegal US sanctions are hampering exports, but that will change if the Iran nuclear deal is revived.
The real game changers will be if Iran comes into international market with full force, increasing its oil exports, increasing its gas production.
It has been confirmed that during their summit on Thursday and Friday, EU leaders debated erecting barbed wire along the bloc's external border to manage the refugee crisis, made worse by the situation in Afghanistan. Ursula von der Leyen says the idea is out of the question. On the subject of COVID-19, the EU has failed to convince citizens in some countries to take the vaccine. For example, the virus is now out of control in Romania and Bulgaria.
Some difficulties that are related to the vaccination hesitancy, and it's why it's also important to cooperate, to coordinate, in order to make also progress on this challenge.
Some EU nations want funding cut to Poland over alleged rule of law breaches. Right-wing leaders, such as Hungary's Viktor Orban, are dead against the move, though.
There is no need to have any sanction. It's ridiculous.
Germany's Angela Merkel, who gave her last press conference at an EU leaders' summit before leaving office, says she's also opposed to legal action against Warsaw. Apart from not meeting the needs of citizens and in turn allowing populism to take hold, critics say another key reason the EU is facing rule of law issues is because those running the project have been too eager to expand at all costs to create a superstate, and in the process have allowed countries to join that do not share EU values. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
France's Minister of the Economy has surprisingly admitted that prices will continue to rise until at least 2023. That coincided with a new poll which showed that 90% of the nation is worried about inflation and decreased purchasing power.
A new poll shows that 3 out of every 4 French people believes that their purchasing power has diminished due to rising inflation, and 90% of the nation is worried about it. The nation's economy minister departed from his Western peers by admitting that inflation will continue to rise until 2023 at the earliest. Combined with unemployment, which was entrenched even before the coronavirus recession, the admission seems to announce the beginning of dreaded stagflation.
La vie est chère et encore plus à Paris.
Life is expensive, especially in Paris, from real estate to basic shopping needs to even the price of a simple lunch. Our purchasing power keeps going down.
The government has just announced a cap on household gas prices until the end of 2022. Natural gas has soared to record highs across Europe. They also announced a one-time payment of 100 euros to those who earn less than 2,000 euros per month, which amounts to 60% of the population. However, many say the one-off payment is not nearly enough.
Ça devient compliqué, ça diminue fortement.
No, it's not enough at all. When somebody is only taking home 2,000 euros a month, 100 euros isn't nearly enough to make difference when it comes to the energy costs. The government is not helping the middle class much at all.
The Yellow Vest protests, which initially kicked off 3 years ago due to rising fuel prices, just began what they called Season 2 last weekend. They are promising to continue marching. By a huge margin, purchasing power is the number one issue ahead of France's presidential election next year, just as it has been in all the elections since the great financial crisis began.
It's really fragile right now. The middle class just isn't seeing a fair relationship between their work and the amount they are paid.
Inflation is being reported seemingly worldwide, as the coronavirus lockdowns may have created a monetary monster. Many economists say the only solutions are controls on prices, as well as corporate profits, and higher wages, which have remained stagnant across the West for decades. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
American social media giant Facebook faces new allegations of pricing growth and profits over combating hate speech, misinformation, and other threats to the public. The allegations are filed in a former employee's affidavit, which has been seen by the Washington Post. The whistleblower says Facebook officials routinely undermined efforts to fight problematic content during the tenure of former U.S. President Donald Trump. The reason, the affidavit says, was concern about potentially damaging effects on the user growth as the key to the company's multi-billion dollar profits. The allegations echo those made by whistleblower Frances Haugen during her testimony to U.S. Congress earlier this month. Over the past years, Facebook and its other platforms, including Instagram, have been criticized for allowing dangerous and criminal behavior, including terrorist content, to ensure profitability. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah. words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
Unity Week. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. We are in the Unity Week. This week begins on the 12th and ends on the 17th of the Islamic month of Rabiul Awwal. Unity is like blood in the body of the Islamic Ummah. Unity requires awakening among Muslims and recognition of the enemy's plots. The Western governments and media have focused for the recent years to strongly tarnish the image of the Prophet of Islam and the Noble Quran. Various attempts of European and American media outlets and writers against the Messenger of Mercy and his divine book have all been done in a bid to hinder the rapidly spreading wave of Islam in the West, particularly among the youth and teenagers. It is very amazing that some of the Islamic regimes have been acted as the pawns of the US and Europe in this regard. In view of the bedazzling spread of Islam in Europe and the US, the Western and Zionist media have made use of modern tools and technologies to stage cultural assaults against Islam and Muslims. The most recent scheme of the Western Zionism against Islam was the forging of terrorist groups in disguise of Islam. These animalistic groups had nothing to do with the teachings of the Prophet of Islam and the Noble Quran. In such circumstances, there have been two opposite currents with opposite functions. One is the current whose ultimate goal is to foment religious, sectarian, ethnic, and language differences to make Muslims and humans suspicious of one another and pave the way for bigger colonialist goals of the global arrogance and Zionism. The other current is built up of reformers who call on humans and Muslims to converge around commonalities, yet united and abandon petty differences. The seditionist current is clearly supported by the domineering system. This system employs direct and indirect methods to cause rifts among Muslims. In the direct method, the statesmen and media of colonialist powers fight unity of Islamic sects and thoughts directly, while in the indirect method, they hire ignorant elements and urge them to indulge in acts that bold difference and arouse sectarian sentiments. The efforts to depict Wahhabism and Salafism as Islam are all made to this end. Along seditionist moves of Westerners and Zionists to sow discord among Muslims, the tendency toward unity that had started decades ago was accelerated by Imam Khomeini's move and the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. In view of this, when some of the European media insulted the Prophet of Islam, tens of millions of Muslims in different countries staged demonstrations against the move. This showed that the Islamic Ummah is alive and wakeful. Furthermore, the Islamic solidarity with the people of Palestine, especially on the World Oaths Day, and Islamic Nation's sympathy and solidarity with the defenseless peoples of Yemen, Bahrain, Afghanistan, Kashmir, Myanmar, etc., clearly showed that the Islamic Ummah is monolithic and united. The enemies of Islam, through highlighting Islamophobia and Iranophobia, is seriously seeking to wedge between Islam and the West, as they know that the Western youth are knowing Islam despite all efforts to besmirch the bright image of this religion. The Western media are trying to hinder the way of Islam into Europe and among non-Muslims. That's why they publish blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet and distort and ridicule the teachings of the Noble Quran. This method is reminiscent of the measures of ignorant Bedouins in the first years of Islam who would try to ridicule the Prophet. The enemies of Islam think that if they tarnish the image of their Prophet, Muslims would gradually abandon the religion, but they should know that they will never be successful. The history bears witness that Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, is the perpetual role model of human perfection, goodwill, peace, and justice, not just for Muslims, but for the whole mankind. Islam stresses solidarity of its followers. The Noble Quran, on the one hand, calls on Muslims to stick to unity and cling to God's cord, and on the other hand, prevents them from severing the bonds of affection and solidarity. Here, we pray for all those who tried for unity among Islamic denominations, particularly the great reformer and enemy of global arrogance and Zionism, Imam Sayyid Ruhollah Musavi Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, who spent his life for this sacred goal.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The United States first entered Afghanistan in 2001. I was 11 years old. When America invaded Iraq in 2003, I was 13 years old. Like many Americans my age, at the time I was given very simple reasons for these wars. Our soldiers were fighting terrorism, supporting democracy, and spreading peace. United States involvement in the Middle East was presented to us as an unquestionably benevolent force for peace in the region. We graduated from high school and became old enough to vote and enlist in the military as President Obama replaced President Bush with promises to end the wars and close Guantanamo. We were welcomed into adulthood with the release of the WikiLeaks Afghan and Iraq war diaries, which challenged the liberation narrative with chilling accounts of civilian death tolls, unreported friendly fire, and revelations from the battlefield. But in the decades since the Afghanistan and Iraq wars began, my generation has come of age in a country struggling to comprehend the true complexity behind these two conflicts. My classmates and I learned about the Vietnam War just as pundits were beginning to debate the parallels between Iraq and Vietnam. We learned about the My Lai massacre in the classroom and recoiled from the modern horrors of Bagram, Haditha, and Abu Ghraib on the nightly news. Crimes committed by soldiers who have returned to the U.S. suggest further urgency as more soldiers return from deployment and try to integrate into life outside the military. For these crimes, both those committed in the theater of war and those committed in the U.S., isolated events committed by wayward soldiers, or are they perhaps symptomatic of wider concerns with the U.S. military, its training and selection and supervision of its soldiers, its capacity to treat and screen for mental wounds, and its process for reintegrating soldiers into civilian life after deployment. What lessons should my generation of Americans, and those that come after us, draw from these wars, from the actions of our soldiers, and the best way forward as they return home?
battle at home. Part 1.
In 2010, the U.S. Army charged five soldiers from its 5th Striker Brigade with the killing and mutilation of several Afghan civilians for sport. The soldiers, who called themselves the Kill Team, included Private First Class Andrew Holmes, who was 19 years old at the time of the killings, and Corporal Jeremy Morlock, who was 22.
As a defense attorney, I'm representing my clients, but I'm also a part of a broader search for truth. And I, too, am interested in the truth, and I'm interested in justice, and sometimes our job as defense attorneys is to ensure that justice is served, and by that I mean that justice is not excessive.
Daniel Conway is a former Marine staff sergeant and a military defense lawyer. Conway has defended numerous soldiers accused of misconduct in Afghanistan and Iraq, including those charged in the Haditha massacre.
PFC Holmes was required to set up security on top of a hill. Now, his team leader, Corporal Morlock, ran to the bottom of the hill and decided, unbeknownst to PFC Holmes, that on January 15th, 2010, PFC Holmes did not know what Corporal Morlock was about to do.
Conway represented Private Andrew Holmes in the Striker 5 case. As the Striker 5 soldiers faced court-martial proceedings in 2011, Der Spiegel and Rolling Stone published gruesome pictures of the soldiers posing with the bodies of murdered Afghans. On January 15, 2010, Corporal Morlock and the so-called Kill Team murdered the first of three Afghan civilians. For months, they had been planning to kill innocent Afghans using unaccounted for grenades.
Corporal Morlock, he took this as a target of opportunity. And Corporal Morlock was at the bottom of a hill, about 110 feet away from PFC Holmes, who was facing the opposite direction. Corporal Morlock spotted two farmers, young Afghan farmers in a field, and motioned for one of them to come over to him like this. He called the man over.
As the farmer approached, Corporal Morlock called for Private Holmes to join him at the bottom of the hill. Holmes was unaware that Morlock was about to act on his plans to kill.
When the man got to approximately 20 feet from Corporal Morlock called for PFC Holmes, who was on top of a hill. Holmes repositioned. Now at that time, PFC Holmes started running down the hill with his squad automatic machine gun and his goggles on. It was hot that morning. Started running down the hill. Corporal Morlock was already behind about a 3-foot high wall. The man was 20 feet away from Corporal Morlock. Corporal Morlock was going through what they call standard escalation of force procedures to ensure that the man didn't have any weapons. So he told the man in the local dialect to lift his shirt to demonstrate that there was no suicide vest. And he told him to turn around.
The man complied with Morlock's orders, clearly showing that he carried no weapons or explosives. Meanwhile, Holmes continued down the hill, stopping to take a drink and catch his breath.
About that time, PFC Holmes was getting down to the bottom of the hill behind the wall. He was out of breath. He was breathing hard. And he kneeled down to take a sip of water. Now, at that time, Corporal Morlock, again, unbeknownst to PFC Holmes, tossed a grenade over the wall. The grenade didn't go very far. Went probably 5 or 6 feet.
Morlock had told his fellow soldiers of plans to murder civilians and frame their killings as self-defense. But until that day, Holmes had not taken Corporal Morlock seriously.
Corporal Morlock's plan, and they had talked about this, PFC Holmes never thought Corporal Morlock was serious about it because it's a psychotic plan. So PFC Holmes never took him seriously. Corporal Morlock drops the grenade over the wall and screams for PFC Holmes to shoot. PFC Holmes stands up, places his squad automatic weapon on the wall, and lets out about a 5 to 6 round burst, which with a machine gun is an instant. Now, whether the rounds actually hit the man or not, we aren't exactly sure. PFC Holmes believed they did. Forensic evidence was inconclusive on the matter. We had probably one of the leading forensic pathologists in the world, Dr. Michael Bodden. And Dr. Bodden was unable to identify any wounds in the photos of the man that were consistent with machine gun fire.
Forensic experts were unable to determine whether Holmes' shots actually hit the civilian man. During his court-martial the next year, Private Holmes said that he knew he should have taken cover against the grenade blast rather than follow Morlock's order to shoot.
Well, PFC Holmes pulled the trigger. He didn't know that the grenade had been on the ground as long as it had, and he was still standing when it was about to detonate. Corporal Morlock screamed, "Holmes, get down," and reached up, grabbed him by the back of his uniform, and pulled him to the ground just as the grenade was detonating, and PFC Holmes nearly took shrapnel to the head from the grenade, which, of course, we believed killed the man.
The Stryker 5 team would kill two more civilians by May 2010. Jeremy Morlock confessed his crimes as part of a plea bargain the next year and was sentenced to 24 years in prison in exchange for testimony against the other four soldiers. Private Holmes pled guilty to the first of the killings and was sentenced to 7 years in prison. The Stryker 5 case was certainly not the first instance of violent misconduct in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. On March 23, 2003, the eve of the Iraq invasion, Sergeant Hassan Akbar killed two of his fellow soldiers and wounded 14 in an attack on a U.S. Army base in Kuwait. Professor Victor Hansen, a former Army JAG officer, led Sergeant Akbar's defense team during his court-martial. Since leaving military service in 2005, Hansen has taught military law and criminal procedure at the New England School of Law in Boston.
On the night of the incidents, he was on guard. He was out on kind of on his own on guard, and while he was out on guard, he got some grenades and he got some ammunition, and he left his post and he went over to another area in the unit and walked through that area. He went opened one tent. He knew these were officer tents of other officers in his unit, and he threw a grenade into one tent and began firing. He struck a couple of people with the weapon, with his firing. He went into another tent, I believe, threw a second grenade, fired some more rounds from his rifle, and then he went into a third tent and did the same. He shot and killed one person in that tent, and then another person who was outside of the tents, a captain, he shot him, I believe, two or three times and killed him as well. He was quickly apprehended after that and confined, and then the criminal process against him began. Sergeant Akbar, who was a soldier in the 101st, was the one responsible for initiating the attack. So Sergeant Akbar was a soldier in the 101st Airborne Division. They were in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. He was a combat engineer. He had been in the Army 4 or 5 years by this point. He was a little older. He had graduated from college, just barely. Didn't really have any success finding a job, so he joined the Army right before the beginning of the military operations in Iraq. And the decision was made when the 101st Airborne deployed to Kuwait that Sergeant Akbar would go with the unit and deploy. And more significantly, and frankly more troubling to me, was that he was put in a leadership position. And he just was not capable. He was not competent to be leading other soldiers. He was prosecuted. He ultimately did receive the death penalty, so he's now at Fort Leavenworth on death row.
As with Jeremy Morlock, there were signs that Sergeant Akbar was unfit for armed service. Investigations after the attack revealed the sergeant had a history of behavioral issues before deployment and found that he was even known for violent sleepwalking episodes. Still, the 31-year-old was sent to Kuwait ahead of the Iraq invasion.
In terms of the debate as to whether PTSD or TBI, to what extent those conditions are responsible for a soldier committing murder, I personally, having dealt with a number of these cases, would be reluctant to ascribe an individual's conduct to a brain, to suggest that those things have caused them by themselves to commit violence. No, I think there's some other factors involved than just TBI or PTSD, and it's almost always a personality defect.
In the Stryker 5 and Akbar cases, lack of supervision and screening of soldiers clearly played a significant role. But what about in other instances of military misconduct, such as Abu Ghraib? What role did factors such as training and orders from superior officers play?
So I got a call one day basically from my senior JAG officer, and he said, well, you need to fly to Germany and visit and meet with General Sanchez. He was certainly responsible for directing some of the initial investigations. We've all seen the photos, and they're horrific. I think the feeling that I had, like many of my fellow service members, was just a feeling of disbelief. Couldn't believe that this would happen, that our service members would be involved in something like that. It was, sickening. That's kind of the overall feeling that many of us felt. At the end of those investigations, there were some certainly very critical. Some critical findings that found that he and his leadership team had not done everything that they should have done to ensure that these things didn't happen and to clarify what our responsibilities are. One of the most significant, I think, investigative outcomes was the determination that some of the interrogation techniques that had been used in Guantanamo had migrated, it was the term that these investigations used, had migrated to Abu Ghraib. And so the soldiers who were there at Abu Ghraib were using the same kinds or had been told about these investigation techniques at Guantanamo and were using the same kinds of techniques.
Abu Ghraib exposed to the world a shocking image. American soldiers committing acts of torture. As pictures from Abu Ghraib surfaced and details of the U.S. torture program became known, the world and U.S. citizens alike wondered what had led soldiers to commit such acts and whether their leaders had ordered them to do so.
The word was passed down, quote, gentlemen, the gloves are coming off, along with a list of torture techniques that was brought over from Guantanamo via Afghanistan. Even though this was rescinded some weeks later, it sent a message. This is the kind of thing that we want to do. There was incredible pressure on people to get intelligence.
Orders such as the gloves are coming off suggested that the rules for proper treatment no longer applied. Memos and emails from within the Bush administration directed interrogators to break detainees.
There was a commander in Iraq who, when that message about taking off the gloves happened, he sent a response and said, gentlemen, let's take a step back, let's take a breath, and think what we're doing. And he put the orders out, there will be no abuse in my command, and there was no abuse from what I understand. But that was not what was done in general. What was done was the message sort of was, well, we don't torture, however, do whatever you have to do to get the intelligence, because they were in a situation where they occupied Iraq, it went very smoothly. Within a couple of months, this insurgency developed. They hadn't anticipated it. They were so self-absorbed, it never occurred to them that people in Iraq might not take so kindly to being occupied by Americans. They didn't know what was going on. They were desperate to get intelligence, and they sent down basically the command was do whatever you have to do.
It was awful news from Afghanistan. A stunning and so far inexplicable mass killing by an American soldier inside a small Afghan village. That soldier acting alone, U.S. officials say, opened fire early today just outside his base in Kandahar province.
Certainly when you see a situation like Sergeant Bales, who had killed 16 people in Afghanistan, anytime you see something like that, I think almost the first thing that comes to mind is something's wrong mentally. How could you otherwise explain what's going on?
In 2002, he was accused of assaulting a girlfriend and was required to undergo anger management. In 2008, he was cited for leaving the scene of an accident. He joined the Army soon after the 9/11 attacks. Over 11 years, he was deployed to war zones four times. He reportedly suffered a traumatic brain injury when his Humvee rolled over.
So clearly, they're under a lot of mental stress. It could be raised to the level of insanity. When you see a situation like this, I mean, I think the natural reaction for anybody is, how could it not be a factor in explaining their behavior? The reality is that these people are put under an enormous amount of stress. If you have a soldier who's deployed and been subjected to combat and the stresses of combat and traumatic brain injury, concussions, those kinds of things, of course, it's going to have some consequences.
Between 300 and 500 unarmed civilians were massacred by American soldiers at My Lai, Vietnam in March 1968. The shock and revulsion from My Lai prompted the U.S. military to re-examine its rules of engagement and battlefield training. Instances of gross misconduct such as Abu Ghraib call into question the high standards put in place after the Vietnam War.
During Vietnam, there was an incident referred to as the My Lai Massacre that occurred towards the end of the Vietnam War, where you had a platoon or a couple of platoons of infantry, American infantry, that assaulted a village and massacred civilians, 400 or 500 civilians, just massacred them in cold blood. And as a result of that and other situations that had occurred during Vietnam, the morale in the force was very low at the end of the Vietnam War. And there was a feeling among the American people that the military was not, you know, was not an honored profession. The reference you often heard at the end of the Vietnam War is that soldiers were referred to as baby killers. And that was directly coming out of that My Lai massacre incident.
Instances of misconduct like these may be the exception. But just as generations will remember My Lai as a defining event in the Vietnam War, events such as Abu Ghraib, Haditha, Bagram, the Stryker 5 killings, and others will always define how the world perceives the U.S. and its role. Misconduct by soldiers is not limited to crimes committed overseas. An outbreak of violent crime and fatal shootings by soldiers from one Colorado combat brigade prompted David Phillips, a reporter, to investigate its source.
It was only one battalion, one group of about 500 guys, that almost all of this violent crime was coming out of. And when I saw that, when I saw that it was just coming from more or less one specific group, I said, my God, what happened to these guys collectively in their experience, in their deployments to Iraq, in their time coming home that would lead to this? When we looked at what made that unit different, it was pretty stark. They had been deployed to Iraq in 2004 to the worst place in Iraq, a stretch of road between Fallujah and Ramadi. And they had taken casualties at a rate that was four times that of other combat units. And then they came back after a year there, and they were supposed to have about 2.5 years to sort of recharge and reorganize here in the United States. Well, the Iraq war was going so bad that the Army couldn't spare them that time. And so they sent them back to Iraq after only 1 year. Again, they were sent to the worst place in Iraq. This time it had moved to downtown Baghdad. And again, they faced casualties that were several times the normal rate. Now, when these guys started melting down from being in the field facing death daily and watching their friends be maimed or killed, there was really no good plan in place. There was no plan to take care of them, to treat their mental wounds. And so a lot of times, if these guys started losing it, the battalion's solution was, hey, this guy's too dangerous now to be in Iraq, so let's send him back to Colorado Springs.
Courtney Lockhart and Kenneth Eastridge both served in the Fort Carson Lethal Warriors Brigade. Both were convicted of murder after returning from Iraq. In total, 12 soldiers from Lockhart and Eastridge's brigade were arrested for murder or attempted murder after returning from Iraq.
There may be other battalions that have a very similar story to this one, and we just don't know about it. I got to tell you, the military is not advertising when they have outbreaks of violent crime. There may have been something to do with the culture of this unit that made it particularly susceptible.
Eastridge was convicted for the killing of another 24-year-old veteran who had served with his unit in Iraq. The victim was shot 3 times and left on the side of a road. Eastridge confessed to being an accessory to murder in the case. In 2010, the Army released a study on the health effects of repeated deployment. Research found that soldiers with previous deployments were more than 3 times as likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. Some soldiers deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq served 3 or 4 tours, sometimes back to back.
In the limelight.
Colin Powell, who was a military leader and key strategist of an empire that killed countless people and undermined the sovereignty of multiple nations, has died at the age of 84. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by John Coeli, journalist. This article is published under the heading Colin Powell, who helped George W. Bush lie nation into Iraq war, dies. Stay tuned for more. Colin Powell, the former U.S. Secretary of State who helped President George W. Bush, under whom he served, to sell the 2003 invasion of Iraq to the United Nations and the American people, has died at the age of 84. According to the New York Times, he died of complications from COVID-19, his family said in a statement. He was fully vaccinated and was treated at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, his family said. In 2003, Powell, a retired four-star U.S. Army general who also served as chairman of the Joint Chiefs before becoming the nation's top diplomat under Bush, made the now infamous presentation to the UN Security Council, in which he claimed that the Iraqi government of President Saddam Hussein was hiding a secret chemical weapons program from the international community and supporting international terrorists following the 9/11 attacks of 2001. Powell later claimed that the testimony he gave in 2003 was a great intelligence failure. But critics, including his chief of staff at the time, Lawrence Wilkerson, said the speech was significant both for its dishonesty and that Powell's gravitas was a crucial part of the two-long-year effort by the Bush administration to get Americans on the war wagon. That effort, Wilkerson wrote in 2018, led to a war of choice with Iraq, one that resulted in catastrophic losses for the region and the United States-led coalition, and that destabilized the entire Middle East. In a 2018 column detailing what the former Secretary of State knew and was saying privately at the same time he was selling the Iraq invasion to the U.S. public, The Intercept's John Schwartz wrote that Powell's loyalty to Bush extended to being willing to deceive the world, the United Nations, the Americans, and the coalition troops about to be sent to kill and die in Iraq. He's never been held accountable for his actions, and it's extremely unlikely he ever will be. Powell's friends in America tend to briefly note in the soft glaze of his own regret the most consequential act of his life. On February 5, 2003, Powell made a 76-minute speech to the United Nations Security Council in which he argued the Bush administration's case for invading Iraq. He insisted that Iraq's leader Saddam Hussein was overseeing a secret program to make weapons of mass destruction. Powell brandished satellite photos of what he confidently said were decontamination trucks, aluminum tubes, and other WMD paraphernalia. He even held up a vial that he said could contain anthrax. There was, of course, a big problem with all his assertions. They were lies. The intelligence behind his speech was the opposite of emphatic. It was false, manipulated, and fabricated. The trucks were just trucks. The tubes were just tubes. There was no anthrax. There was, more fundamentally, no reason to invade Iraq. Nonetheless, thanks to Powell's presentation, the Bush administration went ahead with his plans, and in the ensuing catastrophe, at least several hundred thousand Iraqis lost their lives, as well as more than 4,000 U.S. troops. Scholar and journalist